It was a lunchtime argument among East Boston High School students that quickly fizzled. But what transpired that day in the cafeteria set a series of actions into motion. And 3 years later, the repercussions are still unfolding for one young man named Orlando. As WBUR's Shannon Doodling reports, his story shows how a seemingly mundane high school argument can have a big impact when reported to federal immigration officials. Our story begins in El Salvador.
The small city of Metapan is about a two-hour drive from the Salvadoran capital of San Salvador. It's close to the border with Guatemala. This is where we meet 22-year-old Orlando. It's a hot and humid afternoon, and he wipes sweat from his forehead every now and then. He says it's safer for us to talk at the plaza instead of meeting him at his grandparents' house.
So you've been back here since January. What is life like here?
Life here is really hard. I can't find a job here. There's nothing. It's really dangerous. There's too much death here and fear. There's a lot of fear.
We've agreed to use only his middle name. Orlando fears for his safety in El Salvador and for the safety of his grandparents. Orlando was born in Metapan, but it's never really felt like home. He says he was abandoned by his mother when he was younger and was more or less raising himself much of his life. And that's why he decided to find his dad. He was 17 when he started the journey alone, heading north toward the U.S.-Mexico border and ultimately East Boston.
It was awful. I had to travel by land, and it was hard. There was a lot of suffering. I was mistreated a lot along the way.
He says he was kidnapped in Mexico and held hostage for almost a month before he escaped, illegally crossing the border near McAllen, Texas. He arrived as an unaccompanied minor in 2014 and was released to his father in Boston. He obtained a special immigrant juvenile visa and applied for a green card. He was working and going to school. He says he felt safe in Boston.
I don't know. I guess I got used to being with my family. That's what I wanted the most.
And then, in 2015, on a Thursday afternoon in November, all of that changed.
So as you can see, there's a number of files and folders. You can also see FedEx envelopes that included filings to the Board of Immigration Appeals.
Sarah Sherman Stokes opens the top drawer of a filing cabinet in her Boston University Law School office. Sherman Stokes represented Orlando in his immigration proceedings. She thumbs through dozens of folders, all related to Orlando's case.
I mean, it does feel in some ways like this sort of tomb where all the papers came to die.
Two of these papers, an incident report filed by an East Boston high school police officer, triggered what comes next. The report cited what began as a few students heckling another student in a classroom. The class dismisses and moves into the cafeteria for lunch, at which point a few of the students confront one another. What follows is described in the report as an unsuccessful attempt at starting a fight. One student is cited as saying he heard from friends that some of the young people involved might be part of a gang. According to the report, school police officers reviewed security camera footage. Orlando was identified as one of the students involved. In the report, he's listed as an associate of the gang MS-13. The incident description ends stating, quote, "This incident will also be sent to the BRIC." That's the Boston Regional Intelligence Center. It's a unit of the Boston Police Department that gathers and analyzes intelligence, which is shared with federal law enforcement. 9 months later, Orlando was getting ready to go to work at a nearby Mexican restaurant when he was arrested at his father's home by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. That two-page school incident report had made its way into what's known as a gang packet, information compiled by Homeland Security Investigations, or HSI. It's unclear how, but Orlando allegedly evolved, in the eyes of authorities, into a verified and active member of MS-13. Those were the classifications printed in all capital letters on the first page of the government's gang packet. Here's Sherman Stokes.
The maker of this report is usually a special agent from HSI, and that person's usually not available in court to be cross-examined. One of the problems here is it's a black box. You know, it's not clear to us how this determination that the client is a verified and active member of a street gang, how is that determination made?
The government's case also included pictures printed off Orlando's Facebook account. Handwritten notes in the margins and arrows point to details like blue shoelaces and a Chicago Bulls hat as alleged proof of MS-13 affiliation. Orlando, for his part, insists he was never involved with the gang. Sherman Stokes says he has no criminal record. Around this time, East Boston and neighboring communities were experiencing a spike in violent crimes, believed to be associated with organized gang activity. Many of the victims were young men of Central American backgrounds. In January 2016, federal, state, and local law enforcement made arrests throughout Greater Boston, leading to a sweeping indictment of more than 60 alleged MS-13 members and associates. Just last month, one of the members was sentenced to life in connection with the killings of two teenagers in East Boston. The victims had been stabbed dozens of times. Orlando's school incident report was sent to the BRIC by a Boston school police sergeant. According to a transcript of immigration court testimony, the officer says he received no specialized training in identifying gang activity, but has learned how to identify gang behavior after years on the job. He goes on to testify that keeping track of gang behavior is a big part of his duties at East Boston High School. School police officers are employees of Boston Public Schools, not the Boston Police Department. In an email, a Boston Public Schools spokesman said the Boston Police Department provides regular training to school police officers on gang activity. Thomas Nolan is a former Boston Police gang detective and a professor of criminology. He says he's concerned Boston school police officers are performing more like Boston police, but without the proper training.
Boston school police are putting in information into the BRIC database that's oftentimes not only inaccurate, but they're exceeding the bounds of their authority.
Nolan also worked for the Department of Homeland Security, the federal agency overseeing regional intelligence centers like the BRIC. He's traveled around the country training law enforcement on the kind of information that should be shared in these databases. We showed him the school incident report alleging Orlando's gang association and describing the incident in the cafeteria.
Well, someone receiving this kind of information at the BRIC needs to make an assessment as to whether or not this is appropriately included in the criminal intelligence database. And if this was something that I saw, I would never put this into a criminal intelligence database.
The Boston Police Department did not respond to requests for comment. Some Boston school police have exercised their authority off school property, which, according to Boston Public School officials, is beyond school police jurisdiction. Six students listed in a Boston School Police intelligence report obtained by WBUR were stopped and frisked in 2017 by Boston School Police at a dog park in East Boston. The intelligence report was included in one of the federal government's gang packets. It was filed by the same sergeant who alleged Orlando was a gang associate. Nolan now does some work as an analyst, evaluating information for immigration attorneys whose clients have gang packets. He questions whether city leaders are fully aware of the way information flows between Boston school police and federal immigration officials.
This city, Boston, represents itself as a sanctuary city. It certainly conveys the idea that its law enforcement agency will not cooperate and facilitate deportations and ICE detentions, when in fact the Boston Regional Intelligence Center is doing just that.
WBUR submitted repeated public information requests to Boston Public Schools, asking for details about training for school police and other incident reports that included gang allegations. Despite winning an appeal from the State Records Office, WBUR received a response from the City of Boston saying the records are part of active litigation and would not be made available. The ACLU of Massachusetts recently sued the Boston Police Department, asking for access to the gang database and citing an uptick in gang allegations being used to keep people in detention and, in some cases, as a basis for deportation. After spending more than a year detained in immigration custody in Boston, Orlando signed his own deportation letter in 2017 against the advice of his lawyer. He says he was too depressed to wait out the appeals process behind bars. Sitting in Metepan, Orlando stares out into the plaza, reflecting on his life in Boston.
Working and studying and everything. I was doing all that when they grabbed me. My life was ruined. And truthfully, I don't know if I'm ever going to have another opportunity like that.
Orlando is still adjusting to his surroundings in El Salvador. He's looking for work, but says he spends most days in the house, just sort of passing time. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Shannon Dooling in Boston.
Some people, many of them students, are living in the U.S. with a single entry visa, and it's very difficult or even impossible to leave the country to see their families and then re-enter the U.S. In recent years, the Trump administration's travel ban has made visitation even harder. With families from these countries barred from entry, it can be years between visits. But there's a library that straddles the border between the U.S. and Canada that offers an unusual way for families to reunite. We have featured the Haskell Free Library and Opera House on our show before. A theater troupe was putting on a cross-border musical there. Now this little library in Derby Line, Vermont, and Stanstead, Quebec, has become a space for Iranian families to reunite. Yegana Torbati wrote about this for Reuters, and she joins us now. Welcome to Next.
Thank you so much for having me.
So in this piece, you focus on two families, and maybe we can start by talking about Shireen Estebanati. Tell me the story.
So Shireen Estebanati is a student in New York City studying engineering. And like many Iranian students, she is here on a single entry visa. And so that means that if she were to leave the borders of the United States, she'd have to apply for another visa to come back in. And there's really no guarantee that that would happen quickly enough or at all to enable her to continue her studies. So she's, for all intents and purposes, stuck here. And then because of the travel ban, her parents are basically have zero chance of getting a visa to the United States. And, you know, since the last time she had seen her father, he had had a heart attack. She hadn't been able to leave to check on him. And so, you know, she was very much wanting to see both of her parents. And so in August, her parents, who had traveled to Canada on Canadian visas and were staying with her sister there in Montreal, they came down to the library from the northern side, and Shireen drove up to Vermont from New York, about a six-hour drive, and they basically met at the library over the course of 2 days.
So here's Shireen talking about her reunion with her family at the library in a video that accompanies your piece. Let's listen.
I don't know. The time I was just hugging my parents, I was thinking, I wish I could stop all clocks all over the world.
It's really powerful. What was it like to see these reunions?
So I didn't witness Shireen's family reuniting, but I did witness a couple others in early November just by chance. You know, I decided to go up there myself and saw two families who decided to come there that day to reunite. And it's extremely powerful. I mean, they're very emotional moments. You're seeing people seeing each other for the first time in several years. There's, you know, immediate tears, really long embraces, and just, you know, the sheer pleasure of being in the company of your mother, your child, your brother, your sister, someone you haven't seen in months or years. It was really powerful to witness.
So tell us more about the Haskell Free Library and Opera House where these reunions are taking place. It's a very unusual building in an unusual place.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a very small library, just a couple reading rooms and a stacks area and sort of a main hallway. And it's really a relic of this era where the international boundary between the U.S. and Canada was sort of an afterthought. There are these communities that have been there for early in the 20th century, if not longer. And in those days, like, they were just sort of almost a, like, one town, but just happened to be built across this border. And so there was a local wealthy family that built this library and endowed it and purposefully had it built across the border. And a few years later, I believe that actually became illegal. So this sort of institution was kind of grandfathered in and allowed to operate. But, you know, it's very rare and very unique that an institution open to the public would be built across an international boundary like this.
But how exactly does it work with Border Patrol from both the American and the Canadian side? We can all picture the Border Patrol officers that sit as you're trying to get up to Montreal or back into the United States at these almost toll booths. But it's not like that at the Haskell Free Library. Explain exactly how the customs piece of this works.
Absolutely. And it's sort of hard to understand unless you go there yourself. But essentially, there is a port of entry very nearby the Haskell, just a few hundred yards away. And that's an official port of entry. And it really does look almost like a drive-through window. It's pretty small operation. But then at the Haskell itself, the border between the U.S. and Canada is just demarcated by a line of flower pots. And the library is sort of sits kind of like squarely across the border, but its only entrance is on the American side. And so there's basically been an agreement, a special dispensation that the library has, whereby Canadians, people entering from Canada, can park on the Canadian side. And then they walk on the sidewalk up to the library front door and go in. And then as long as they, when they leave the library, they go back to their cars, go back to Canada, then it's all fine.
I want to hear from another one of the people that you profile. This is Sina Dadsatan. He's an Iranian who lives in Canada. His family visited the library so that they could see his sister who lives in the United States. Let's listen.
If my parents come next year, and if this travel ban still exists, maybe we do the same thing again. Maybe, because we are not breaking any law. This is the only solution we have right now. And if they're going to stop us from this way, we try to find another solution.
Is there a sense that someone might want to stop this type of reunion?
So, I mean, it's a fraught situation. And I heard several stories from people about Border Patrol agents trying to stop them from meeting, telling them that, you know, it was no longer allowed, chastising a library staff member who allowed one of these families to enter after a Border Patrol agent had told them that they couldn't. You know, the head librarian told me that both RCMP and Border Patrol had threatened to shut the library down over the visits. RCMP flatly denied that, and U.S. Customs and Border Protection, which oversees Border Patrol, didn't directly respond to my questions about that. So the visits are fraught. The library itself, before I ever reported the story, had issued a formal policy saying that family gatherings are not permitted, and they put signs up throughout the library saying that. But the signs are very easy to overlook, and the families that met there on the day that I was there in early November just hadn't noticed them. And the library staff members allowed the visits to go forward. So it's sort of this, it's almost like a literal gray zone because it is on the border and it's sort of both Canada and the U.S., but also it's like a gray zone in the sense that they're kind of operating in this quasi-allowed, quasi-not-allowed space. And so it sort of remains to be seen if the visits will be allowed to go forward. But, you know, you saw in that clip with Sina that this is something that these Iranians have turned to out of desperation, out of feeling that they really have no other legal option, that this is their one legal option to be able to see each other.
Yegana Trabati is a reporter for Reuters. You can find a link to her story at nextnewengland.org. Yegana, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You hear a lot of news about the nation's southern border, but what about security on New England's border with Canada? Some people believe that when it comes to border security, the nation should focus on the potential for terrorists to enter the U.S. from the north. Lauren Matalon reports on the potential security threats along the northern border.
Customs and Border Protection pilot Gerhard Perry flies along the northern border, where Vermont, New Hampshire, and New York meet Canada. He flies an infrared camera-equipped Cessna on patrols that can last up to 4 hours. When people ask him about his work, he always has to explain it's the northern border.
When you ask the average American citizen about the border, what do you know about the border? They immediately go to the southern border. They don't even think about our border with Canada.
Before his northern deployment, Perry flew borderland missions in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas, a mix of river, bramble, thicket, and border towns. So he knows both borders well and says you also have to look north.
You know, you have large population centers within 100 miles of the border. You have Toronto, you have Montreal, where these organizations may be operating. If you're going to address terrorism, the northern border is where to look.
Perry was in the air in 2014 when word came about an act of terrorism that changed Canada, and with it a review of terrorism threats in Canada and security on its border.
This is CNN Breaking News.
A Canadian soldier has died after being run down by a car driven by a suspected Islamic militant.
First, the soldier was murdered in a deliberate hit and run near Montreal. The same week, an ISIS supporter killed a soldier at Canada's War Memorial. He then entered Canada's parliament, where he was shot dead. In his cockpit, Gerhard Perry pulled in the signal from an AM radio.
As I'm flying, I'm looking over, and this occurred just a few miles from where we were. I was horrified. I was like, good grief, in Canada? You
know, there are about 16,000 Border Patrol agents on the Mexico border. There are about 2,000 on the Canada border, which is twice as long as Mexico's. The U.S. Attorney for the District of Vermont, Christina Nolan, says she has concerns about the northern border.
One of the first things that naturally comes to mind is what we know to be certain radicalized populations in Montreal and other parts of Canada. And we know about
Nolan recently met with Canadian prosecutors.
They indicated to me they had a healthy docket of cases pending that involved homegrown radicals who were attempting to travel overseas and fight for ISIS.
In response, Canada has made preemptive arrests. In the past 3 years, at least 10 students have been arrested before leaving Montreal allegedly to join ISIS. An alleged ISIS cell was uncovered in Ottawa in 2015, and in another case, a Kuwaiti-born Canadian has pleaded guilty to plotting attacks for ISIS in New York. In November, Canada's Minister of Public Safety, Ralph Goodale, revealed the number of people who've come back from places like Afghanistan.
The number of returnees known to the Government of Canada is in the order of 60.
Canada's intelligence service also says it knows of 180 people with ties to Canada engaged in terrorism activity abroad, with about half believed to be in Syria or Iraq.
We overemphasize security on the southern border, and we don't emphasize enough security on the northern border.
That's security specialist Howard Campbell at the University of Texas at El Paso, across the Rio Grande from Juarez, Mexico. His book, Drug War Zone, looks at trafficking in both cities.
If Homeland Security is really concerned with security and the biggest security threat is terrorism, we should be more worried about the Canadian border than the Mexican border.
President Trump's portrayed a southern border that's under siege. He's stated that drugs and undocumented migrants are pouring into the country. He's made that assertion even as the administration's latest statistics for April show illegal border crossings held steady last month and that illegal crossings are in line with historical trends. In El Paso, Howard Campbell says people arrested crossing in from Mexico may be committing an illegal act, but he says they typically pose no threat of terrorism.
Because Mexican and Central American migrant workers are not a terrorist threat to the United States.
Canada's 2018 budget includes $173 million for greater security along the U.S. border. Intelligence sharing between the U.S. and Canada is robust, with a longer tradition of mutual trust than between the U.S. and Mexico. And that could mean U.S. law enforcement's presence on the northern border might continue to be dwarfed by what Washington has committed to the south.
Border Patrol agents arrested 20 people for entering the country illegally in Vermont, New Hampshire, and New York in just one weekend in April. Helping people cross the border illegally, or human smuggling, is something people take for granted along the southern border, but it's also part of life on the northern border, where human smugglers and law enforcement are playing a cat-and-mouse game. Here's Lauren again.
Richard Ross is the agent in charge of the U.S. Border Patrol Station in Newport. He's a native Vermonter who worked previously in borderland Texas. Ross says the volumes may be smaller and often the profiles different, but he says human smuggling from Canada on the northern border is a constant.
It absolutely is sophisticated and organized.
Ross runs one of 8 stations in the Border Patrol Swanton sector. The sector covers Vermont and parts of New Hampshire and New York. There's boundless tree cover, rivers, and large lakes like Champlain and Memphremagog with shoreline in both countries.
If you have that type of transnational criminal organization, this area is very appealing.
In October, 3 people were charged in federal court with allegedly orchestrating a 15-person human smuggling attempt that used a Vermont motel as a way station. In November, Two Americans seen circling an area near the border were charged with smuggling two Mexicans. Then in February and twice in March, Border Patrol agents intercepted similar smuggling attempts.
We have had two groups that happen to be Romanian drive vehicles.
Two of the three cases unfolded beside the Haskell Free Library and Opera House in Derby Line, Vermont, which faces Stansted, Quebec. Outside the library, a street with a simple marker and some flower pots marks the border. There's just enough room for a car to squeeze between the marker and the state of Vermont.
So they came right up here over the sidewalk, came out here, took a left, and Interstate 91 is about a minute away.
Last year, agents in the Swanton sector arrested 165 people trying to enter the U.S. illegally. That's a 22% decline over 2016, when 214 people were caught. But Border Patrol intelligence agent Rob Dandrow says business is still good for human smugglers.
We've seen that these organizations can sometimes charge individuals anywhere from $2,000 to even upwards of $25,000, $30,000.
The cost in Mexico, between $3,000 and $8,000. Dandrow says human smuggling needs accomplices on both sides.
They will usually recruit drivers and foot guides, whether it be in the U.S. and Canada, usually both countries, to actually do the physical smuggling themselves.
Agent Ross says they also use scouts.
We'd be foolish to think that we were running our operations and they weren't running any against us to see where they could cross and when they could cross.
Canada's trying to better track who comes in and out of the country, and it's working with the U.S. to do so. Canada's begun sharing data with the U.S. on American citizens who cross into Canada. Legislation in Canada would also establish exit controls. Without them, the government says it has no reliable way of knowing if visitors ever leave the country. David Berger is a Canadian immigration lawyer who served for 16 years in Canada's parliament. He says people will swipe their passport as they exit Canada.
And we will have a record of when they leave the country. We've never had that before. And we will share that information with, presumably, the United States.
After the presidential election of November 2016, a number of people began entering Canada illegally from the U.S. Back in Vermont, Border Patrol agent in charge, Richard Ross, says agents are expecting a boomerang.
And some of those folks have realized that they're not going to be allowed to stay in Canada. So we are seeing some of that traffic come back to us.
Canada's announced that it will allow 1 million migrants into the country between now and 2020. Not all will end up staying permanently. Those who guard the northern border say that almost certainly means some of them will take their chances with human smugglers to try and enter the U.S. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Lorne Madelon.
We've been following stories of New England residents who've made lives here but are now facing deportation. Robert Garova of NHPR found that it's a complex and confusing process for the family of a New Hampshire man who came here as a child. They're looking for answers on where their son will be sent.
Agieth Okeni fled war in Sudan with her four children. In Egypt, she says she applied for refugee resettlement.
I took my children. I came with them. They asked me an interview. Do you have a specific place to go? I say no. I just want to live with my kid. I need the safety place to be safe with my children. So they brought me here to Manchester.
That was 18 years ago, and she's been in Manchester ever since. In that time, Okeni has seen her three daughters off to college. One of them is now training to be an airplane pilot. Another I spoke with is serving in the Peace Corps. Okeni also has a son, Haitham Bol, who she says was 9 years old when he arrived in the U.S.
Haitham was doing very good. He went to high school here.
That's Bol's stepfather, Chris Okeni, who also came to the States as a refugee from Sudan.
He had a job. He played football. He was a couple of times in a newspaper. He was, doing good in a community.
But his family says Bol began to run with the wrong crowd. In 2015, Bol pleaded guilty to possession of a controlled drug and receiving stolen property. He was sentenced to serve time in state prison. This past December, Okeni says he was released from prison in Berlin. Bol had gotten into a lot of trouble, but he was hoping to start anew. But shortly after getting out of prison, Okeni says her son, who does not have U.S. citizenship, was arrested by ICE officials, held at a jail in Dover, and told he would be deported.
So I tried to contact to find any help, nowhere to get help. I'm still running to find a way to help my son.
Okinney says she's been trying to get her son legal help, but has struggled to afford an immigration attorney. This became even more difficult when Bol was moved to a different facility halfway across the country.
My name is Hayton Bol, and I am in West Texas.
I reached Bol at an ICE holding facility in Sierra Blanca, Texas. Bol says his voice was scratchy because ICE officers used pepper spray on him and others. He also says detainees are resisting deportation.
Many of us here, we have old people that really shouldn't deserve this treatment or the way that they're forcing us. But it's really a first time I've ever witnessed anything like this. And it's very rough. It's rough.
Here's where the story gets more complicated.
I was told I'm going to be deported to South Sudan.
Bol and other detainees I spoke with on the phone are worried that they will be put on a flight to South Sudan, a country that has been engrossed in war for more than 4 years. Detainees say ICE officers have verbally given them this information.
I have never in my life been to South Sudan. I have no idea what South Sudan looked like.
Bol says he was born in Khartoum in the north, during a time when North and South were one country. Since then, South Sudan has gained its independence and is now among the world's most dangerous places, where reports of child soldiers and rape are commonplace and the risk of famine is severe, according to the United Nations. ICE says it does not give out deportation schedules, but provided that, in general, quote, removals of aliens who are under a final order of removal from an immigration judge are done only to the individual's nation of origin, not to third countries. It's difficult to know for sure where ICE plans on deporting Bol or others, or whether or not they will be transported elsewhere after a possible initial landing in South Sudan. Alyssa Steglish is a professor at the University of Texas School of Law. She says concerned family members of individuals in detention with Bol have reached out to her.
We remain concerned about access to counsel, and conditions in general.
Steglish thinks this may be the second attempt to deport dozens of people to unstable countries in Africa.
So it certainly raises concerns that not only are we pushing ahead with deportations, we're doing so in a way that does not respect the dignity and basic human rights of those who are being deported, and that is doing so in a way that does not allow for new protection concerns to be heard.
Another detainee I talked with said he was originally from Gambia, and lawyers in Minnesota are working to block deportation of a group of Somalis believed to be in the same group. Bol says he's being held with 28 like him, people who he says are worried they too will soon board a flight to South Sudan. Bol's mother, Agyeth Okinney, who is now in contact with a lawyer, says she's left in the dark and worried her son will be sent to a highly dangerous country he has no connection to.
No home, no safety. My big problem is no safety. Where are they taking them? And I ask, where is my son? Where is going? Nobody tell me.
Husband Chris Okinney says he feels like he and his family, who came here legally as refugees, are being treated unfairly.
This is not America that I know. All of us here, we came, we did our best, we became part of the community, we go to work, we pay our taxes. And we should have a right the same with other people in America. He's fearing for his life. We fear for his life.
Immigration experts I spoke with say the deportation process isn't exactly transparent and extremely difficult to fight without good legal help. So for now, Okinney waits for the next phone call from her son, hoping he will have more information for her.
No one listening to me. I feel now like I'm still in Sudan, 'cause they say I'm an American citizen. So we have a right to say something and somebody can listen.
Okinney says she understands her son has broken the law and may be deported to South Sudan or elsewhere. But she wants people to know her story in the hopes that it will save others from the same fear and frustration. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Robert Garova.
With President Trump's increased focus on immigration enforcement, more families are facing the kinds of questions that Robert just explored. But the stakes are also higher than ever for Customs and Border Protection, or CBP, officers. These are the people working at official ports of entry, and they decide who enters the country and who doesn't. But that broad authority has some civil rights advocates raising concerns. WBUR's Shannon Dooling recently left New England to visit the Federal Training Center that houses the Academy for the CBP.
At the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Brunswick, Georgia, a group of 14 trainees, just 4 days into the Officer Academy, are wearing dark blue uniforms and carrying heavy backpacks. These hopefuls are training to become CBP officers. You may have handed an officer your passport at the airport or when you crossed the U.S.-Canada border. The curriculum for a CBP officer is broad, from constitutional law and computer training to firearms training and tactical role play. But as Branch Chief Nick Sunderhouse says, the focus is always on security.
Because at the end of the day, yes, we're facilitating travel and trade, but we have people that want to harm us and have ill will.
Since November 2016, getting into the training academy may have gotten a little easier. Some specially qualified applicants no longer need to take the entrance exam, and CBP is accepting older applicants. President Trump has not mandated a hike in hiring for CBP officers like he did with border agents. But Sunderhouse says there's been a bump in candidates coming through the academy, and morale is good.
CBP is hiring. The morale here from the trainees coming in, we see that because they got a job that they applied for that they wanted to do.
For 26-year-old Patrick Provost of North Kingstown, Rhode Island, becoming a CBP officer is all about job security.
At the time, I was applying to almost every opening I could find on USA Jobs. Steady income with good benefits. I do have a criminal justice degree, so I'm always trying to look for the next step.
And after graduating, the next step for Provost is up to Norton, Vermont, where he's been assigned to a border crossing in one of the most remote regions of New England. It's there that his CBP training will be put to the test. The job of a CBP officer is quite different than their counterparts, border patrol agents who roam the places along the border in between the official ports of entry. There are more CBP officers in the force than there are agents. And according to CBP statistics, officers at ports of entry seize far larger amounts of drugs like opioids than border agents. And officers also arrest more wanted criminals at ports of entry. As Sunderhouse explains, that could be because officers have a whole lot of data at their disposal.
There's so much information that we're able to utilize in our systems that allow the officer to make a really good assessment when they see people coming at them, to be able to say, that person's going there, this person's going there.
While CBP policy prohibits racial profiling, officers do have the authority at ports of entry to look beyond the computer systems, using what's called their border search authority to take other factors into account.
Things you're wearing, how your mannerisms are, all those things can still come into play, and then that would fall under border search. How often that happens, there's no quantitative number.
That's because these interactions aren't always documented.
It's not kept track of because sometimes I might get that intuitive speak and nothing comes out of it. Or I looked and I didn't find anything. It's not saying I might not get them next time, but only if there's an apprehension, a seizure, would that data be collected.
In other words, an officer may decide to follow a gut instinct and ask additional questions. If that hunch comes up empty, then Sunderhouse says it's not necessarily kept track of. And for some civil rights advocates, that presents a problem. Carol Rose heads up the ACLU of Massachusetts.
The problem here is that officers bring their own subjective bias to the situation. And if they're not actually measuring their success rate, there's no way to actually judge or to know whether their training is working or not.
This is part of what's at question in a case filed in Boston federal court by the ACLU of Massachusetts and others. They're challenging a growing practice of searching travelers' electronic devices without a warrant. In fact, CBP's searches of electronic devices have nearly tripled since 2015. CBP, though, says these searches still only impact a fraction of the traveling public. The plaintiffs in the lawsuit are 10 U.S. citizens and one lawful permanent resident, several of them Muslims or people of color, whose smartphones and laptops were searched at the U.S. border without without warrants.
These people were subsequently not accused of any wrongdoing. So we do have instances of when people are wrongfully stopped, wrongfully questioned, and in this instance, having their cell phones and their laptops confiscated and viewed and kept for weeks or months.
Oral arguments in the Massachusetts court case begin in late April. Back at the facility in Georgia, officers are training with real-world scenarios. Dozens of role players are waiting in lines, just like you'd see at an airport customs checkpoint. They're each playing different characters, different travelers that a CBP officer is likely to encounter. Some may take on the role of refugee, others could be hiding something sinister. The actors have detailed instructions, like to smile and flirt with the trainee, or their script may call for them to avoid eye contact, bite their nails, and appear to be nervous, like in this case.
All right, Mr. Madison, if you step aside for me one second, someone's going to come in and escort you to secondary. They're going to ask you some more questions, and we'll take it from there. Okay? Thank you very much.
A CBP trainer cracks a grin of approval. The officer in training successfully sidelined a would-be smuggler.
Next passenger. Good afternoon, ma'am. How are you?
Hello.
Can I see your passport?
For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Shannon Dooling.
A few weeks ago, we heard about a mobile Mexican consulate set up to help migrant workers from that country who provide a lot of the labor for the state's agriculture industry. Despite a state policy that discourages local law enforcement from turning undocumented immigrants over to federal immigration officials, there is still a big risk for these workers. As VPR's John Dillon reports, a recent case shows that state police and migrant justice advocates interpret the fair and impartial policing policy very differently.
Sivers Coleman Lopez, docket 468-11-82-ANCR.
It's arraignment day in the criminal division of Addison Superior Court in Middlebury.
Can I see if Mr. Lopez is in the hallway too? Okay. Is Coleman Lopez in the courtroom?
But one defendant, a 47-year-old farm worker named Oman Lopez, is a no-show.
Mr. Lopez does not appear. There's a citation in the file. It does appear to bear the defendant's signature having been signed by him. This is a DUI and leaving the scene case. What's the state's request?
Judge Allison Arms issues an arrest warrant, but Lopez is already in custody. He's in a federal detention center in New Hampshire, awaiting deportation back to his native Costa Rica. Lopez was arrested in early October for driving while drunk and for leaving the scene of an accident. The facts of his arrest are not in dispute. But after his arrest, a state police officer called Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and that night, an ICE agent picked him up at the New Haven, Vermont State Police Barracks.
In this case, a Vermont State Police Barracks was turned into a holding cell for Trump's deportation agents.
Will Lambeck is with Migrant Justice, a group that advocates for migrant farm workers. He says turning Lopez over to ICE runs counter to the state's model fair and impartial policing policy.
This is precisely the type of outcome that the fair and impartial policing policy is intended to prevent. But the state police have not updated their policy as required by multiple versions of state statute.
Lambeck says the reason why the Oman Lopez case is important is that undocumented people in Vermont are often reluctant to call law enforcement or even 911 for a medical emergency because they're afraid they'll get turned over to ICE. Olga is an undocumented farm worker who says she's been afraid to call an ambulance during a medical emergency. One of her children also gets asthma attacks, but Olga says she's been too scared to take her to the hospital.
So she said that there were plenty of occasions she needed to call an ambulance for an emergency. She heard that even the police is turning people to immigration, and that could, you know, if she calls for an emergency, maybe police is going to be involved. So she's been really afraid, and at her household, everybody's been afraid to reach out to an ambulance or to the hospital or the police.
I think they're confusing the facts here, and they're aware of that.
Lieutenant Gary Scott is the director of fair and impartial policing for the state police. He says migrant justice, not state police, is creating the atmosphere of fear.
I think there's two different things going on here. If people are in violation of the law and they are arrested, there are consequences. But if you're a victim or a witness, and our policies clearly state that, we're going to help you and we're not going to ask those types of questions. And that's been in place for a significant amount of time, many, many years.
Scott says Lopez was stopped for leaving the scene of an accident at a convenience store. A police report says he initially showed a blood alcohol level of about twice the legal limit.
So in compliance with our policy, he was under arrest. The troopers had the discretion to make a call to federal authorities if they wanted to further investigate what the status of this visa was. And it was learned then that he had overstayed. So the processing was completed when Border Patrol came.
The key word here is discretion. Scott says under both the state police protocols and the model fair and impartial policing policy, the officer was still allowed to call ICE after the arrest. He says this case is the only one in the last 2 years in which ICE was contacted after the state police stopped an undocumented person.
We are training our members to take everything into consideration when they're doing that, but ultimately it comes down to discretion of arrest and what are the extenuating circumstances of that arrest.
But Migrant Justice says the officer's discretion in this case, which led to his decision to call ICE, shows the weaknesses in the state police policy. Will Lambeck again.
Under the state's policy, Ullman should not have been referred to federal immigration authorities. But the Vermont police's policy doesn't have the language, it doesn't have the provisions that speak to these practices. And that's why this trooper was able to call a deportation agent up and say, hey, I have this person in custody.
Federal law on this issue is clear. The state cannot prevent an officer from calling ICE. So what the officer did here was technically allowed. Migrant Justice has pushed to make the policy more restrictive on information sharing. Attorney General T.J. Donovan says he's working with state police on adopting the state's model policy. He says he can't second-guess the call made in the Ullman Lopez case.
And I think when you're talking about a criminal investigation, that's a little bit different than some other interactions police would have. But I think the intent behind the policy is the same. You're really encouraging folks perhaps not to call, but you can't prohibit the call. And if you make the call, to be mindful of some of the consequences.
Meanwhile, Lopez is in detention, separated from his wife and three children as his case works its way through the federal deportation process. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm John Dillon.
Today, we begin with the story of a family separated one by one along strict lines, their differing immigration statuses. Saying goodbye at Boston's Logan Airport is a familiar and painful scene for the four Macario brothers. Just 2 years ago, they said goodbye to their father when he was deported back to his native Guatemala after losing an asylum case. And early Wednesday morning, the oldest brother, Isidro, faced the same fate. Accompanied by federal immigration officers through airport security, Isidro was bound for deportation back to Guatemala, where he was born. Just a few days ago, I met with the family at their apartment in Lynn, Massachusetts, to hear more about the impact of legal status on their lives.
Anthony and Saul.
The Macario brothers, four of them in all, are looking at old school photos hanging on the wall in their Lynn apartment. They're poking fun at the haircut their dad gave one of them back in the third grade. There's a plastic pitcher of pink Kool-Aid on the kitchen table and a Bible sitting on top of the microwave. The youngest brothers come out of their room one by one, 21-year-old Irwin, 18-year-old Anthony, and 16-year-old Saul. They're each wearing some variation of sweatpants and sweatshirts. They all know this could be one of their last nights together with their eldest brother, 27-year-old Isidro. After several years of receiving stays of his removal from the U.S., he's run out of options.
You know, it didn't start yesterday. It's been going on for almost 8 years straight.
Isidro Macario says worrying about the future is just a part of life for his family. They're accustomed to receiving regular doses of anxiety, usually in the form of correspondences from the Department of Homeland Security. And usually they come in the mail around Christmas time.
I remember most of the time we are in the living room receiving letters saying that our parents have to leave the country. And instead of, you know, having a table ready for the family, we get these letters or bad news. It always happens. So
Isidro Macario was born in Guatemala and came to the U.S. when he was 13 years old. His younger brothers are all U.S.-born citizens. John Moen, a spokesman for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, said in a statement he could not comment on the details of Isidro Macario's deportation case, but confirmed he was scheduled for removal. Isidro Macario has applied for different legal statuses, but criminal charges, stemming from what his lawyer calls a misunderstanding a few years ago, stood in his way. Those charges were dismissed in 2013, according to court documents, and he has no criminal convictions.
You know, it's very tough for myself and also for my family because, you know, we've been struggling with this for so many years, and instead of getting better, we... You know, it keeps getting worse and worse and worse, and nobody understands probably our pain.
Isidro Macario is the oldest brother and also doubles as a parent to his younger brothers. Their father was deported back to Guatemala in 2016. Their mother, Marita, is in the U.S. without documentation and also has a removal order. For nearly 2 months, she has been seeking shelter in a church in Greater Boston. We've agreed not to use her full name and not to disclose her location because she fears for her safety. Marita says being separated from her sons makes her ill. But for now, she believes living in the church is her safest option.
Por mi familia. Yo no los quiero dejar.
I'm here for my family, she says. I don't want to leave my sons. I'm sad, but I'm also okay here. I'm in good hands. I miss my sons, and I want to be with them because they need me, and I need them too. This type of family upheaval is becoming more common, according to some immigration advocates, especially in families like the Macarios, where different members hold different immigration statuses.
For example, an undocumented mom with two citizen children and a husband who has, let's say, TPS.
That's Ava Malona, director of the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition. She says mixed status households are common across the country and here in Massachusetts, given there are nearly 1 million foreign-born residents in the state, half of whom are naturalized citizens.
It's a huge concern emotionally, but also practically, because, you know, these individuals are part of the workforce, they're consumers, so it's really, really problematic and widespread.
President Trump's shift in immigration enforcement priorities, the debate over DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, and the elimination of temporary protected status for some countries have all created cavernous unknowns. The uncertainty facing these mixed status families from one day to the next can sort of feel like whiplash. It's a feeling that 16-year-old Saul Macario can relate to.
When I see it taking them one by one, that's how I see it. First it was my dad, then my mom, my brother.
With the hood of his sweatshirt pulled down low over his forehead and his hair just slightly in his eyes, 21-year-old Erwin Macario says he's been thinking a lot about what it would mean to be the oldest in the house.
It's a lot to take in, to take care of my little brothers. It's going to be a lot of responsibility, but at the same time, it's going to help me mature. And if anything, you know, I got them, and I'm going to push through just for them.
More than 7,000 Salvadorans living in Massachusetts and Connecticut with temporary immigration status face potential deportation next year when the humanitarian program called TPS, allowing them to live in this country, expires. Connecticut Public Radio's Diane Orson reports on two state residents who must decide whether to return to El Salvador or prepare to become untraceable.
Sitting in his tidy apartment in Bridgeport, 38-year-old Jose Zavala describes crossing the U.S. border in 2001 when a major earthquake hit El Salvador. The disaster allowed him to receive legal protection known as Temporary Protected Status, or TPS. He came to Connecticut and began a job at a car wash where he's worked for 17 years. He got married and took a second job at night cleaning office buildings. Savala's 9 and 6-year-old daughters play quietly nearby, but they're listening in on the grown-up conversation.
When I had my first daughter, I thought, this is it. I'm here to stay, and this is going to be their country. This is where they're going to be growing up.
Now the family's future is unclear. The Trump administration plans to terminate TPS for El Salvador and 6 other nations. TPS is granted to foreign-born nationals when extraordinary circumstances like environmental disasters or armed conflict make it unsafe for them to return to their native countries. Savala says he might go back, but he might not.
If I don't have TPS, I might have to live a life of hiding however I could. I don't know. The worry is mostly for my daughters. Sometimes my wife will say that I might have to go back to El Salvador, and my oldest, Lisette, she says she doesn't want me to leave.
Savala's wife is undocumented and does not have TPS protection. She spoke to WNPR on the condition that we not use her name.
Yes, it's sad because we've had so many years together, had our daughters and raised them, and now we're facing the prospect of him having to go back. It's ugly. It's sad. It makes you sad to know this.
And worried. U.S. officials say conditions that originally led to El Salvador's TPS designation no longer exist. But previous administrations extended TPS for other reasons as well. They determined that poverty and gang violence made it almost impossible for the small Central American nation to safely reabsorb 200,000 Salvadoran TPS holders from the U.S. El Salvador has one of the highest homicide rates in the world, and the State Department has warned U.S. citizens to reconsider going there. Another longtime Salvadoran TPS holder from Bridgeport, Juan Mejia, says he's anxious.
Imagine, I've lived here feeling protected, and suddenly all that protection is taken away. I feel uncovered. I feel like I've lost what I had for all this time.
TPS has allowed Mejia to work legally in the U.S. since 2001. He's a gas station attendant during the day and a part-time janitor at night.
My life would change drastically if I became undocumented. I might not be able to hold the jobs I have now because I'd have to show my documents. I wouldn't be able to have a bank account because the first thing that they asked me when I opened it was for my Social Security number. Getting car insurance would be impossible. So would renting an apartment.
According to the Center for Migration Studies, 88% of Salvadoran TPS holders work in the U.S. labor force. Many, like Mejia, support their families back in El Salvador by sending remittances. Glenn Formica, an immigration lawyer in New Haven, describes temporary protected status as a hugely important foreign policy device.
When you have remittances, Western Union sends it right to the person who's trying to rebuild their house. And it costs the United States taxpayer almost nothing because the person who now has a temporary work authorization, he's asking the United States government for an opportunity to work. So for the people that view that, you know, there should never be a government handout, TPS, to me, is the absolute best policy you could have for economic development in a region.
Formica says most TPS holders who had other ways to gain legal status have already elected for them. So with TPS ending and no comprehensive immigration solution in sight, families like the Savalas face a tough choice. They could be torn apart, or the TPS holder can prepare for life as an undocumented immigrant under a constant threat of deportation. Savala's wife says hers is by no means the only family in Connecticut confronting this choice.
Lots of families, many here in Bridgeport in the same situation. Lots of families.
For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Diane Orson.